podcast this week. Once again, we send our war rig to Interview Town to interview Imperator George Miller, director of Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. Witness him! Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast, that of Jürgen Norbert Klopp. I can only say this. Of all the souls I have encountered in my travels, his was the most human.
Oh boy.
Human. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. Joined once again in the studio in the pod booth this week by three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Helen O'Hara, our geek queen, is here. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well. I went to see Spirited Away last night at the theater.
Oh,
it was very
nice.
Good, except I was in the cheap seats and they were unbelievably shit.
That's what I've been saying all
They're
along.
Not always. This is unusually bad.
How cheap were the cheap seats?
35 quid.
Fuck me. All right. Okay. I mean, our definition of cheap is very, very different.
I mean, compared to the top seats, that's very cheap in this.
Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't sound bad for a theatre seat.
Oh, it used to be £10.
When?
10 quid? It used to be like
at
today.
The Colosseum? You
went to Italy?
The other one.
To watch them throw Christians to the lions?
Yes.
£10 is a bargain for
that. Oh, good so, right? for you, says Christian as he was thrown to the lions. We're also joined.
Lions fucking distracting!
We're also joined by.
Lordy.
Oh, shut the fuck up. We're also joined by our great big fucking nerd, James Dyer. Hello. We're also joined by our resident George Harrison lookalike. It's John Nugent. Hello, John Nugent.
Hello. Another auspicious introduction for me. Thank you.
Yeah.
How are we all? We all good?
Good.
We are
excellent.
Good.
Excellent. We are none of us. Is it only me who is bereft by the departure of Jürgen Norbert Klopp?
It is.
Manager of Liverpool Football Club.
I mean, like, sympathies to you and all, but yes, no one else cares here.
Yeah.
Well, Helen, that is where you were right. But it was a hell of a day. A hell of a day. And in a totally organic move, well, look at that. This week's listener question is about great movie farewells. How did that happen, folks?
Wow, does this question come from a C. Hewitt?
From a Hugh Chrissett? My name is Mr. Burns. It's not far off. So basically, I asked a whole bunch of people yesterday. I took to Twitter and said, could someone ask this question, please? And so a few people did. Duly Noted 90 said, what's your best farewell to an actor in a film, specifically within the context of a given franchise?
No.
Shug Hamster, what is your Mount Rushmore of movie farewells?
Oh,
they're playing me like a violin. They know I love a Mount Rushmore question. But yeah, loads of people asked that question, and
yes,
they
in response to your request for them to ask that question.
They cooperate with my demands.
Yeah.
What I want this to be is a discussion about great movie goodbyes or farewells. Now, this is obviously open to interpretation, but in my mind, I'm kind of keeping, for the most part, death scenes off the table.
Okay, so no Spock, no Tony.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Yes, E.T. Spoilers for Wrath of Khan and Avengers Endgame there. But I'm thinking no death scenes unless you can make a really, really good argument for it. This is, I want a scene in a movie where one character says goodbye to one or more characters and then never sees that character or characters again. So it's not like they can say goodbye in a film and then they show up in the next film.
Goodbye, see you tomorrow, doesn't count.
Yeah, doesn't quite count.
Well, hang on. Okay, now that's a wrinkle. Because something like Stand By Me...
Mm. Right.
Right, has them all saying goodbye and going their separate ways at the end. And it's not a big deal because they know they'll see each other in school in a bit. But then the narrator over the top tells us about River Phoenix dying, which actually still hits pretty hard. And that gives it a whole other dimension.
Another dimension?
Another dimension.
Another dimension. Okay, well, listen, as I said, if you can make a justification for this and you can make a good argument for it, then I will accept it. So you're saying Stand By Me?
I'm saying, no, as one of my answers. I mean, obviously,
as one of your answers. Yeah. We're not doing Mount Rushmore of farewells, but we're just going to throw some farewells.
Okay, well, I'm not going to be moved from the number one spot on this, which is a death scene. But I reckon, but the death comes at the end of the goodbye scene. So I reckon then even if you carve off the death, I can have the goodbye. Uh-huh. And it is, of course, Terminator 2.
I thought you were going to say that.
Of course it was going to be
just
Terminator 2.
Brad Fidel's score, like, playing it, you know, is he, you must lower me into this deal.
And it's cannot self-terminate.
It's just, that, like, every time I watch it, it gets me right there. I can't, and then the thumb, oh my God! It's just, I mean, it's extraordinary.
You could get away, and on technicality, it's not a death scene, it's a termination.
Yes, right. Yeah, and also, he was never alive because he's a robot.
Exactly.
So, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting... I mean, if he has enough self-awareness to be aware of self-terminating and what that means...
Self-terminating.
Yeah.
Then he arguably is sentient and is alive. This is an interesting question addressed in one of this week's films.
It is indeed, so. Yes.
Or maybe he can't because...
The Garfield movie.
It is something I can never do.
That's right.
I know now why you cry.
It's magnificent and I love every second of it.
Well, for me, I think the most obvious and definite number one, at least in terms of screen time, is Return of the King.
Well, which one? All 15 of them?
Yeah. It's a full, like, half an hour of goodbyes.
Are you thinking the Into the West in particular or all of them?
That's
all
the one that gets me. But yeah, all of them. Yeah.
There's like five solid goodbyes.
Oh, yeah. It's endless.
And it's like the long goodbye, isn't it?
Yes.
It's like the long goodbye.
Very much so.
Ironically, not that long.
No, not that long at all. But okay, this is Frodo in his bed, and they all gather around and go.
No,
hey.
No, that's a hello scene.
Is it?
No, yeah, the killer in Return of the King. I don't know if you agree, John, but the killer is at the Grey Havens.
No, it's Sauron, Helen. He's the killer.
Thank you.
Return.
Yes, you're very funny.
The killer woke up before dawn. He put his boots on.
Where you know Frodo announces that he's going on the ship too, and Sam is taken aback. That. Is the goodbye scene.
Yes, that is sad. Although it is also at the White City, there's that's sort of a goodbye where Aragorn is like, my friends.
You bow to no one.
That's kind of a goodbye.
No, that's really good. I'm not saying that's not good. I'm just saying the one that gets me.
Yeah.
But that's a coronation, not a goodbye.
But, it's a goodbye in the sense of that's the last time we see Aragorn.
That's the last time we see Aragorn.
But we see him.
They kind of soften the blow of it being the last time we see Aragorn by having conditioned his hair first, so it doesn't really feel like him.
And his beard looks really good as well. His beard is really thick and lustrous.
Are there any shots in the original trilogy that are still Stuart Townsend? Like where they couldn't be arsed reshooting with Viggo?
I don't think so.
I don't think there's any shot in that trilogy where they couldn't be arsed, in fact. I think that's one of the things that people love about that trilogy. Every single shot, they were arsed.
Yeah, which differentiates it from the other trilogy.
Which other trilogy?
Exactly.
Mm. Oh, I see. I fell for your trap. okay, interesting. Any more you want to throw at me? I have a list. The list is life, and in fact, that is one of them.
I'm going to throw out
Oscar Schindler in Schindler's List.
The I could have done
if
more.
He could have saved one more. Scene.
Yeah. Oh boy.
Yeah.
I can't even.
That's a rough one.
Truman Show.
Going up the stairs.
Mm.
That's a great one.
Good afternoon, good evening, and good night. What a farewell.
that hits hard.
And then he gets immediately killed.
He does, in a hail of bullets.
Like Florence Pugh. Florence Pugh 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 and Little Women. How does she say goodbye in that movie?
Bam, 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 bam.
Doesn't say goodbye. She lives to, fight again.
Does she wipe a tear of... Who else is in that film?
Saoirse Ronan.
Does she wipe a tear off Saoirse Ronan's face and go, I know now why you cry, but it is something I can never do.
Because Amy is the worst, except I was the best Amy.
Okay, that's a strange last line, but there you go.
And then there was the hell of
the visionary genius of Greta Gerwig. Miles ahead of her time. Miles ahead of her time? Can you be miles ahead of your time? Shut up. Anyway.
Before Sunrise.
Goodbye before sunrise.
They arrange to meet again.
I'm disqualifying
on the
that because well, they meet again.
But not in that film.
You've already rode roughshod over my rules once before. Fair. I'm not accepting it a second time.
Fine.
Okay. Casablanca.
Oh, yes. That was brilliant. Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's a good one. What happens in Casablanca for those of us in this room who don't watch films in black and white?
I've seen it. In fact, I saw it with Helen.
I insisted he see it.
Did you like it, James?
It's no Die Hard, but yeah, it's fine.
Just routinely, he wake up in the morning going, what can I do today? I know I'm gonna be the goddamn worst. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to aspire to that.
Yeah.
Mission accomplished. What happens in the Casablanca?
In Casablanca, Rick insists that Ilsa get on a plane with her, okay, admittedly, husband.
I don't know why you cry, sweetheart. Apparently, something I never do.
Because her
That's
husband.
That's meant to be Humphrey Bogart.
Because her husband is basically. It was not great, yeah. Her husband is basically going to win World War II by personally killing Hitler or something. And so, and Rick knows that, you know, he needs Ilsa with him to do that. So he insists, for like the good of everybody, that she go with Victor Laszlo, and he then goes off to join the French Resistance with his police chief buddy,
and opens a Café Artois, does a Café René in France. Would it be amazing if
Good
that
morning.
Was the twist of a low alone that René was Rick all along.
I have a massage from Michel. God help anybody who doesn't remember an obscure 80s comedy.
Alo-Alo is not obscure. Alo-Alo is one of the most popular sitcoms of all time.
I mean, in this country, maybe, but it is also 40 years old at this point. So
you're 40 years old at this point.
Oh, thanks. 3.
Toy Story 3.
And he explains to her what they mean to him.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And Andy says goodbye to them forever. And also his own childhood.
So long, partner.
Oh, yeah. God.
Oh.
So long, partner.
It's almost like that was the perfect ending to that series.
And that's where they ended.
Yeah,
and
there was never another one.
I like Toy Story 4.
Get out!
It's a good film.
You mother forky.
Can we talk about the E.T. now?
E.T. I know now why you cry, but it is something I can never do. Sweetheart.
So is that Bogart as E.T.? I'm very
confused. Bogart having a stroke. I'm not sure.
Bogart as E.T. doing Terminator 2, I believe.
Naturally. Yeah.
I may have lost track.
I'm afraid I can't self-terminate.
Why are you holding two fingers up? It's very confusing. Oh, I see. Yes. Okay. Now it all makes sense.
It's like Jack Black in School of Rock. Read between the lines.
Yeah.
And then he holds up three fingers.
Oh, that's rude.
Yes.
Does he have a good goodbye?
No.
No. Okay.
Mr. Schneebly.
Mr. Ned Schneebly.
Okay.
Helen was explaining.
Oh, sorry. My apologies.
No, but the goodbye between E.T. and Elliot, who will presumably never meet again, unless, you know, a new age of interstellar peace is ushered in somehow later.
I've been on the Universal Studios ride where you go back to E.T.'s home planet with Elliot, so...
Is that canon?
No.
I think so, yeah.
I'm willing to allow
Do you fly
that.
By canon? No.
No, just by bike.
I refuse. But yeah, that is... It's devastating. I just every single time I watch it, even as an adult, I'm still absolutely destroyed by it.
I'll be right here. In terms of the Spielberg goodbyes, is that... Higher or lower than Schindler's? Higher or lower than Schindler's?
Oh, come on. You have to play the game. I will not do it.
You must?
Nope.
What about when Indy says goodbye to the Ark of the Covenant? I was thinking about this because in Last Crusade, the Grail Knight, they wave goodbye to the Grail Knight, doesn't he? Before he gets crushed, presumably, by hundreds of tons of rubble. What a life that man led. Sitting alone in that cave for hundreds of years. And then some Nazis turn up, and then within hours, he's crushed under rubble.
Wow.
That's not good.
Minutes, really? Yeah.
Minutes,
but then
yeah.
He is immortal as long as he stays there. So maybe he just now lives under rubble.
What do you mean he's immortal as long as he stays there? It's not a great existence if you are pinned
squished.
To the ground. Squished, in fact, by rock.
It's not the best.
He is like meant to have lived a good life, right? He's meant to be this saintly dude. So I feel like God's probably like, you know, lifted him out of it at that point. I mean, like, up to heaven rather than out of the pile of rock and back into the wee room beyond it.
Yeah.
Any other great Spielberg farewells that are sad?
I was absolutely over the moon when West Side Story finished.
Does that count? Why are we getting back to this? He is banned from mentioning that. We're putting that on the list with Molly's game. He's just not allowed to talk about it anymore.
James was waving at the screen.
Woohoo! I'm out of here, fuckers!
Oh my God. John,
freedom!
No, that's Braveheart. And that's a death scene.
John, do you have any more farewells?
I had Dead Poets Society.
Oh, yes.
Captain.
By the way, I have a list.
Get on the desk, John.
I have a list here, and several of you have QI klaxoned the hell out of this list already. I think only one of you has Toy Story 3, but I did consider it. But you said that one, didn't you, John?
Helen said that.
That's not on my list. But so far, you've you've ticked off my list very, very nicely. But John, please continue.
Well, that's mostly what I had to say.
Great.
It's just like, I don't know, if it's one of those scenes that feels like it's been parodied so much that you forget the original. Like, have you seen that Saturday Night Live sketch?
Yes, very, very funny.
Where just everyone stands on their desks and then they just hit the fans and just like people's heads start getting decapitated.
Yeah, one guy gets decapitated and everyone else starts throwing up and then other people start dying horribly. And it's Fred Armisen as the Robin Williams character.
But it's disqualified because they do meet each other again in the recent Taylor Swift video, Fortnite. So.
Who does?
What?
Josh Charles and Ethan Hawke.
But he's not in that
quote,
scene.
Quote, unquote, reprise their roles.
Oh, no, he is. He's
But it doesn't matter. It's not about them. They're not saying goodbye to each other. They're saying goodbye to their teacher, John Keating, played by Robin Williams.
Exactly. That is true.
And they don't see him again unless there's a reunion many years later, which would be really, really deeply weird. Shall I say some of my little list?
Sure.
Oh, James is about to speak. I can tell that intake of breath. I recognize it anywhere. I'm going to be the worst.
I'm not going to be the worst. I think this is a good one. I think you will all be on board with this. Furious 7. Paul Walker, Vin Diesel, through the car windows.
QI Klaxon, that is on my list.
That is a pretty good one, actually.
Yeah.
But it's good because of, you know, factors off the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of Furious, what about Fury Road? When Max and Furiosa share that look as she rises up on the platform and he melts into the crowd and presumably they never see each other again. It's not an amazing one, but that it sticks in my mind because I was trying to think of scenes where the camera is moving away from a character, and one that was stuck in my head was the end of LA Confidential, where Bud White and Lynn drive away and they leave Ed Exley behind, and that whole end of that film is a goodbye, and the final shot is of Ed Exley diminishing in the frame as they drive away from him. So I was thinking of that. I was thinking of Fury Road as well.
Those are good ones.
Thank you.
Lost in Translation.
Yes, but I don't like the film.
Oh, well.
I'm not sure that's an official objection.
Which is why I did not have it on my list, but I knew someone would say it.
It is a good one.
Is that the criteria you have to like?
Yes.
Yeah, Chris needs to like it.
Right. That's why E.T. and Terminator 2 do so well.
And it's presumably why Armageddon is on your list, where Lost in Translation is not.
Why would Armageddon be on my list?
That's a death scene.
He takes his patch off and he says goodbye and it's like...
He's about to die.
Yeah, you're
obsessed with the
death.
I'm
separating
scenes.
The goodbye from the death. So
I know,
it's fine.
But
no,
the goodbye is because of the impending death.
You're because of the impending death.
It's a fair argument.
He's got you there.
Absolutely. I can't get back to that one.
I'm subbing in Interstellar. To be fair, she's also dying. So I'm not sure that really helps.
Wait, you want the...
I'm thinking final Murph, the final goodbye.
Oh.
What, when she's an old lady, when Jessica Chastain is Ellen Burstyn?
Yeah, because the real heart ripper there is more of a hello, which is the video message, and that doesn't count. So,
That goodbye kind of annoyed me, because it's just like, you've just found your daughter after like years, and you just like, and then swans off to find Anne Hathaway.
In fairness, she does kind of tell him to fuck off, so. Because she's like, she has her own proper family with her at that point.
Does he not get to Anne Hathaway after like 70 subjective years have passed for her too? Is he just going to be ping-ponging back and forth between old ladies? Like, I really did have some questions.
It's like
about
an Ealing comedy.
Hey.
Ping-ponging back and forth between old ladies.
Speaking of ping-pong,
yes.
Do you allow bing-bong?
No, because
it's a death if it's an imaginary character.
I wondered about that.
I don't have it on my list for that very reason. I thought it was a death scene, but I am willing to accept it. Same thing. I thought for sure, John, you would say Matter of Life and Death. Although they do, you know,
they
meet again.
They sort of meet again. That opening scene of that film is incredible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what an amazing goodbye. Yeah, your life and I'm leaving you. Oh.
I know. These prank callers.
So we can't have a death. Can it be someone saying goodbye to someone who's already dead?
Okay.
Are you about to say ghost?
No, that's a good shout, actually. That is a good shout. I was actually thinking of Logan and just the moving of the cross to make it the X, which is an incredible scene.
I mean, if you want to go down that route, then Tony delivers a message from beyond the grave, doesn't he?
He loves the 3,000.
He loves the 3,000. And so does Randy in Scream 3. So it's much the same.
Much the same impact.
So yeah. Similar.
Sorry for all the spoilers, by the way.
We're ruining all the films.
Hopefully you've seen some films. Okay, I'm going to mention some more. I'm going to say real quick.
Okay.
Films I had written down. Casablanca, bing.
Thank you.
Dead Poets Society, bing. Shane.
Now, Shane,
some people believe that Shane dies at the end of Shane, that he slumps over on his horse at the end and that's him gone. Either way, great goodbye. Mm. My beloved possessed goat boy.
Oh, boy.
Sam Raimi's Dark Man, in which the saddest Liam Neeson farewell on screen was Dr.
Oh,
Peyton Westlake.
Westlake.
He's Welsh. Dr. Peyton Westlake.
What one dark man can do, and I can do.
Dr. Peyton Westlake. He says goodbye to Frances McDormand. Says, you'll win 3 Oscars.
Wow.
Oh, but I will be you in all of those films.
And now he's firmly Welsh.
Very firmly Welsh. But I'm moving north.
What is happening? Okay.
Uncharted terrain. And he turns into Bruce Campbell, which is always a great goodbye.
Amazing.
And Bruce Campbell looks back, and he looks back at, you know, wistfully at Frances McDormand and her Oscars, and goes, no. So that's a sad one. Wizard of Oz. But also Top Secret, which parodies Wizard of Oz when they're saying goodbye at the end. And they're getting onto the plane, and Hilary Flamond goes, and I'll miss you most of all, Scarecrow. It's a comedy, James. You'd really like it. The world is not enough. Can you think of the great goodbye
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, okay. Hit me with it, John.
Is it the goodbye of Q?
It is the goodbye of Q. Desmond Llewellyn's final film as Q. He was retiring anyway. Sadly, tragically, he was killed not too long thereafter. But he has a great outline in that. He says, always leave them wanting more, and he disappears beneath the floor.
Aww.
Yeah. And then the last one I had written down was Midnight Run, where Jack Walsh says goodbye to the Duke. And, you know, see you in the next life. In the next life. And
no
they
love.
They have a lovely, lovely moment together.
No love for Wilson. The goodbye to Wilson in Castaway.
Oh, Wilson.
Oh, that was heartbreaking.
Wilson.
But Wilson!
Is that a death scene? Because
yes. No. I mean, does he drown? I mean, he floats. He's quite buoyant. So I'm suggesting that Wilson did not die.
Buoyant, but like...
Also on account of being a volleyball.
Well, yes, that's the point, is it? Like, if Wilson becomes waterlogged and sinks to the bottom of the Pacific, is he alive? And also, is he only, quote-unquote, alive because... Tom Hanks' character, whose name I definitely remember, but I'm not saying right now.
Chuck Nolan.
The Castaway.
The Castaway.
Chuck Nolan.
Jeff Cast.
Chuck Nolan.
FedEx man.
Really?
Yes.
He doesn't seem like a Chuck Nolan.
That is his character's name.
That's amazing.
You can look it up.
I trust you implicitly. But my point is... you know, is he even alive to begin with?
So
Chuck
maybe
Nolan.
It's a death.
Is Chuck Nolan alive to begin with?
Not him.
No, it's just it's Wilson. Wilson's dream. The whole film is Wilson's imagining.
That would explain a lot.
And last but not least, of course, Roy Tin Cup McAvoy. Tin Cup. No, I think I'm done. I think I'm exhausted. Listeners, as always, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of options and answers, and we have only picked a number. James has picked the films he's seen in his life. And the rest of these guys have had a cheeky Google, so it's all good. It's all good. So if you're outraged by something we haven't included, then please know that we're idiots. If you want to have your question read out in the Emperor podcast, you don't have to wait for the greatest Liverpool manager of my lifetime to retire in order to ask a question that I have manipulated you into asking. You can ask whatever question you want to ask. I'm on Twitter, it's at Chris Hewitt. You can slide into my DMs. You can reply to a panic shout out every now and again, or you can reply to any of my tweets once you've stopped laughing, of course. All right, let's move straight into movie news this week because we've only got one guest. But what a guest it is. It's George Miller, and it's a big old chunky George Miller interview. Chunky George.
George
of the podcast. Anyway.
Make him stop.
Movie news. What's been happening in the world of movie news? John, what's your favorite art house director up to these days, John?
Well, I spoke...
Who is your favourite art house director?
I spoke to one of them last week. I'm not sure I'm allowed to say, but...
fuck it.
Peter Strickland. Is...
Peter Strickland? You shouldn't be saying that, John. People might be listening. Yeah, that's exciting.
Unlikely at this point.
We're safe. We're safe. You can say anything. Say your PIN number. Say your account number. No one gives a shit.
Begins with a 5.
That's probably true. If Darren Brown has taught me anything, that's probably true. You've probably hidden a truth in there and you try to distract us by thinking it's a fib.
Oh.
So now all you have to do is just guess the other 7 and your sword code and the my access to the Nugent Millions will be granted.
Is this the Beatles' fortune?
It is. John has been siphoning off George Harrison's royalties for years. Anyway, John, what was Peter Strickland up to?
I was talking to him because he's got a new box set out, which is very exciting, of all of his stuff and all of his short films. James is raising an interested eyebrow.
I do love a short film.
Yes, but he told me as well, I guess this is news, that he's making a kids' film.
Oh, God, that's the most terrifying prospect I've ever heard. I can't wait.
Like a genuine kids film, not a, like an ironic kids film, like a film for kids.
Is this like the Nicholas Winding Refn Famous Five
stuff? I guess
stuff?
So, yeah. Yeah.
What's happening with that?
It's coming out. It's out on Blu-ray soon.
All right.
Yeah, so it must be showing on the BBC soon enough.
Okay.
Which apparently is made without irony and...
There'll just be gallons of blood and...
the first one's a Famous Five, the second one's a Famous Four. the Famous Three, then it's a Garrotted Two, and then it's just Soul Survivor. But yeah,
Who do you think would survive?
I don't know the Famous Five well enough, so I'm going to say...
George.
Daphne.
George.
It's George, isn't it?
It's George.
I couldn't tell you the names of the Famous
George
Five.
George would fuck the others
George
up.
George and... I want to say Julian.
What's the dog called?
Timmy.
You've made that up.
I'm not sure I have.
Does the dog have a name? Dog
Chuck
must have a name.
Nolan.
I know that all the other characters who are not the Famous Five have kind of passingly casually racist names, but I don't think the main core ones are too offensive.
Like Welsh Steve.
George yes, and Julian like and Thomas.
What?
So who's the dog?
I'm pretty sure it's Timmy, but I'm looking it up.
I don't know that it is.
All right.
Wilson. I hope it's Wilson.
Wilson the dog.
Characters. Julian is the oldest. Dick, has a cheeky sense of humor. George is tomboy.
Yes.
Anne is the youngest of the group. And Timothy, alias Timmy, is George's faithful dog.
Look at that dog knowledge.
Anyway, there you go.
Admittedly, I forgot the Dick, but otherwise I knew them well.
I mean, it happens to us all.
Helen sets him up, and due to legal reasons, I can't knock him down. John, please do continue. Are you done?
I think I'm done.
Great stuff.
But we want some actual news.
Yeah, we do want
some
actual news.
That's probably good for a news section. Well, yeah. There's an art house franchise known as the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Oh, yes. I see what you've done there.
Has some news this week, which is that the X-Men movie has a screenwriter.
It does.
Ooh.
Michael Leslie.
Who wrote... The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, which actually, to be fair, was a pretty good adaptation of that. Like that is, it's fucking dark. That, and let's be honest, incredibly long. But it does interesting things. I went backwards and forwards on that film. Like I genuinely, when I saw that, I was like, it's two stars. By the end of the credits, it had gone up to 3 stars. Like I'd actually inflated it, and I've enjoyed it more in the time since I've seen it. So it's going to be a 5-star by the end of the year. But yeah, no, he did a good job of adapting that material. And look, it's early days. I could not be more excited. This is the thing in the MCU I'm most excited about. They are my most beloved Marvel characters. Don't fuck it up. And they're taking their time over it. They're not rushing it. Feige said they're not rushing it. They're doing this deliberately.
I think the interesting thing, we were talking about this just recently in regards to X-Men 97, but I think that was a show that really got a lot of the tone right from what we want for the X-Men. And it kind of, and that's obviously under the banners of, you know, modern Marvel. Feige's name is on there. So that's got to be a good sign. Like they know what... what the core of this is. They know that we need a bit of soapiness. They know that we need a bit of like real world discrimination parallels, kind of real stakes for the mutants in a way that maybe some of the other superheroes don't really have. All respect to Tony, but like he's a billionaire. He has different problems from the X-Men, for example. And I think that there's a lot of dramatic meat there that they can get into, as well as some cray-cray powers that make very little sense.
Yeah, so I didn't enjoy X-Men 97 on account of it being a cartoon, but I did watch the final episode. And there's like 150,000 mutants in that episode. Mm. It is absolutely stacked. So I was quite impressed, because I thought the first episode was pretty poor. By all accounts, it does pick up dramatically after that, obviously.
Massively.
But by the final episode, I mean, they leave nothing on the bench at all. Like, it's all out there.
Did you just skip to the end?
I did, in fact, skip to the end. I did do that because I wanted to. I was being harassed on the Pilot TV podcast to talk about X-Men 97. But I couldn't face watching it.
Was it also because I told you to watch the last 5 minutes because I thought you'd enjoy it?
No, though you did, except I didn't get to the last 5 minutes, so I still haven't seen that.
Oh, boy. So literally, you couldn't make it the whole way through. To be fair, it was a
double episode. It was 45 minutes long. I can't watch 45 minutes of cartoon, Helen. I just can't.
Wow. Once again, his dedication to being the worst is admirable.
Anyway, best of luck to Michael Leslie.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
How are they, forgive me if you've already covered this, but how are they going to, is it the mutants just going to show up one day? Are they just going to be like...
My theory is that the X-Men and the Fantastic Four currently exist in different universes, multiverses, if you will, and that in Avengers Secret Wars, all those universes will collide.
Ah.
And only one universe will be left standing. At the end, it will be the universe of the MCU, and those characters will be transplanted into the world of the MCU.
Tiny comment that I'm literally just thinking of. It might not be strictly the world of the MCU, in the sense that you could alter people's, you know, memories or alter people's perception of reality or whatever, so that certain people never existed, so you get a do-over on people you want a do-over on.
Well, is it going to be like a conjunction of the spheres, like in The Witcher?
Yeah, no, but I think it is going to be like universes kind of combining, right, and interlocking, and suddenly mutants have always been around, and there's always been prejudice against them, and blah, blah, blah. But I think what I'm saying right now is what I hadn't thought of before, is you could actually do it so they're kind of never... people don't have a memory anymore of, like, a Tony Stark who was Iron Man.
That's very...
And that gives you the possibility of a do-over down the line, is all I'm saying.
That's very Age of Apocalypse. That's very kind of...
I'm not saying
I want this. Yeah. I'm not saying it's inevitable. I'm not saying it's what they're planning. I'm just saying that is possible.
Like,
you could lose as well as gain by clashing.
But I feel it's like Candyman. Don't say it aloud, Helen. Like, it might make it real, and I can't have that be a thing.
What Helen said has made me think of you could do that thing, but you could reverse it. It'd be a bit of a downer, but what if it was the MCU Earth that didn't survive, and suddenly it was the Avengers and some key characters, a handful of characters who made it, and suddenly they found themselves in this other universe where mutants already existed. We were talking on the X-Men 97 Spoiler Special, which is up now. By the way, folks, if you want to listen to that, if you subscribe, if you don't subscribe, you should subscribe, empire.supportingcast.fm. But we were talking about one of the problems with the X-Men is that, you know, they grew up in a world where they are hated and feared because they are different, because they're superpowered. But if they come into a world where superpowers already exist, even though the likes of Spider-Man technically is not a mutant, will people really hate and fear them?
No,
I mean, I guess you'd hate and fear Magneto because he's a dickhead who might destroy your planet, but would you really hate and fear Jubilee? Would you really hate and fear Storm? I'm not so sure you would, because weather's been around since the beginning of time. So people would be very used to that, I think. But what if you engineered it so that our heroes, our beloved characters, found themselves in a world where that hatred and fear already existed?
That's interesting.
It's a bummer, but possible.
It gives you a kind of a soft reset as well, which the comics enjoy doing, so that you don't have that weight of back material that people have to buff up on.
And also there's a chance that if you go into that world, then they have a Tony Stark who's less expensive.
Exactly.
No, I feel very strongly that there should never be another Iron Man.
Look,
I really do.
I also actually feel that way. As you know, we have had thrashed this out many times. I'm just saying this would be a way of doing it that would be less objectionable than many.
Yeah. I just feel like...
I can imagine it.
Marvel Universe is full of so many great characters. There's no need to go back to the same well.
I feel like 100 million lunchboxes say otherwise.
Well, yes. The counter-argument to that is money, so...
because capitalism, yes.
Shit. All right. Well, that's exciting, Baby Steps. Do they say anything else about that or when it's coming out?
No.
I assume that's going to come out after Secret Wars, because I think that's when mutants and X-Men are going to be introduced big time into the MCU. But speaking of the MCU, you'll enjoy this, Jimbo.
Oh, you promise?
I will. I do. I shall. I am promising you will enjoy this news story, because this week it was confirmed that the Paul Bettany-led Vision TV show, which I believe is still called Vision Quest, has been dated for 2026 and will be show-ran by Terry Metalis. Am I pronouncing that right, Terry?
Yeah, I believe so, yes.
Okay. Terry Metalis, who...
Of
Jimbo?
Star Trek Picard fame.
Yes.
Yeah. Ah,
and he improved the quality and fortunes of that show immeasurably after Patchy.
He did. I have gone on record many times of being a little bit mixed on the final season of Picard. Famously. In that I loved the beginning of the final season of Picard, absolutely loved it, but I was disappointed with the second half of it, partly because of the direction they chose to go in, not because it was badly executed. I just thought that it was going to a well that had been gone too many times. But what he did was he gave that franchise new energy, 100%. So this is positive.
This is exciting. So this is going to be Paul Bettany as the White Vision, who was created at the end of WandaVision and was last seen floating off to kind of find himself.
Yeah, he'll be in Koh Samui wearing a Stark tooth necklace and, I don't know, hanging out, experiencing the world.
Yeah, whoa, dude. Excited by this? Other people in the room?
But 2026 is a long way away, and the AI is going to kill us
other
before
people.
Then. So. Just saying.
Do you have like a dysfunction where you just hear other people's names and it's like a universal translator. It just translates other people's names as James.
Yes.
James, I have been spoken to. And now I shall hold court.
I generally try to screen out the words that come out of your mouth wherever possible. I just hit, you're like the teacher in Peanuts, like
I've never seen that show because I have a Peanuts allergy. John, Helen,
I Vision Quest is quite a strange name for a TV show. It sounds like a laser quest.
Yeah, I enjoy it for that reason.
What has it been? It will be, 6 years since WandaVision?
It's being directed by Peter Strickland.
He's in.
Count me in.
Well, he did say he was making a children's film, and the MCU is just for children, isn't it?
It's not this isn't cinema in this case.
It's children's cinema.
I'm here for this. I'm intrigued, interested, not 100% sold, but I think Vision Quest is quite a witty name in the tradition of WandaVision. I think that now that White Vision has a little bit more...
We need to change that name.
I'm sure they do. I'm sure that's not their name for him. But anyway, knowing that he has a bit more going on in terms of a bit more sort of soul to him at the end of that show, with spoiler, there's something there to work with. And I think Paul Bettany's great. So
he is fantastic.
I'm optimistic.
All right. Speaking of
Star Trek.
Oh my God, we were on the same segue page.
Were we?
We were. Oh. We were very much on the same segue page. Helen, I will let you take the segue wheel.
Okay,
but not driving off a cliff like the bloke who owned the segue
I might drive it off a cliff because this does involve a prequel. But there is the news that Paramount is launching a Star Trek prequel. And they've got Simon Kinberg on board to bring this new Trek back to the big screen. Because obviously we've got a lot of Star Trek right now on the small screen.
Yes, we
do. Some of it is freaking incredible.
Yes, Strange New Worlds.
Strange New Worlds. And I'm going to add Lower Decks and you're going to not say anything about
cartoons.
It.
Cartoons.
Yeah. So
Jesus. This
is Trek getting back to the big screen. The idea is that this would be about the creation of Starfleet. So we're talking after First Contact.
Yeah.
The Enterprise has come back and James Cromwell has gone on his little flight and met the Vulcans for the first time. And now they're trying to other people are trying to build Starfleet and the Federation.
Not actually the Federation trying to build Starfleet, because obviously Starfleet comes quite a long way before the Federation, because this is taking place in that, as I mean, there's clearly people have been crying out to explore the timeline between Enterprise and First Contact, because Starfleet obviously exists in Enterprise. Mm. I mean, I feel like there are many other things they could have done. This would, I mean, we knew that, we did know it was going to be a prequel. I think they'd already announced that, but it's hard to get excited because when they have played in that particular area, Enterprise doesn't do it particularly well. Prequel stuff can work. So obviously, you know, Discovery started out as a prequel and then went as far into the future as it possibly could do. You know, Strange New Worlds is kind of a prequel as well. Obviously spun off of Discovery season two. I don't know. You're right. Trek is having a good time at the moment. They're having a bit of a moment in the sun, which is nice. I feel like this is perilous. Obviously, they've got the kind of Starfleet Academy thing in development as well.
Yeah, with Holly Hunter right. now so, as president of the Academy.
Yeah, there are a few, and we've got the Michelle Yeoh Section 31 thing as well. So, yeah, look, there's lots of things in development, but there are. I don't know about this.
The good thing about this is one of the Andor's directors, Toby Haynes, is set to direct.
Mm. Ooh.
Which is exciting. And Seth Graham Smith is scripting.
I know.
Anywho.
I know, right? I've seen a lot of discussion this week, you know, about Simon Kinberg's involvement as producer, and I'm guessing, you know, he's
been
known
to hit a keyboard as well.
He has been known to hit a keyboard as well, and I'm assuming he was behind the pitch. He must have pitched for this, and he's, you know, he's been on the podcast. So I think we've all interviewed him. He's, you know, a very, very smart guy. Mm. He knows what he wants. He's great on the story. People will point to his patchy record in blockbusters. You know, when the X-Men franchise, he rose to prominence, a very, very high-ranking position in the X-Men franchise, wrote Days of Future Past. Brilliant.
Yeah, brilliant.
Also produced Apocalypse and then, of course, wrote and directed Dark Phoenix. And so people will go, you know, I saw a lot of Jesse from Breaking Bad GIFs this week. He can't keep getting away with this. But I think it's in relatively safe hands. And then I saw Seth Graham Smith, who is one of my least favorite writers. Having said that, another one of my least favorite writers, Akiva Goldsman, doesn't he have kind of the keys to the kingdom on the Star Trek TV side? And that's turning out okay.
It is.
John, you a Star Trek-y person?
No.
Great. So there was also a story this week that the Paramount, because I am surprised to going down this prequel route. I thought they would have done something more recognizably in the world of Star Trek. But they're still trying to make that happen. They're still trying to make the fourth film with the Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto cast. They're still trying to make that happen, which apparently would be a farewell to that cast. I don't know that we should wait 8 or 9 years and then come back with a farewell movie. I think they should come back and do two movies, and the next movie should be a farewell. If you ask me.
The more the better. Mm. I love those films.
Yeah.
Even Into Darkness, I will watch.
Why?
It's fine.
No.
Helen, just...
I can't... No,
say nothing. I want silence. Do you hear that, James? We're quietly judging you.
Fair enough.
There we go. All right, let's move on to... is franchise a palooza at the moment? It was announced last night that Adam Wingard is not going to be returning to direct the next installment in the Godzilla/Kong saga because Legendary want to, I'm not saying shit them out, but they certainly want to make the next one fairly quickly. And he has already moved on to making a smaller, more Adam Wingard-y movie in between the two behemoths and his dance cards full. He wants to do it.
You don't want to stand between those two behemoths. I mean, if those films have taught me anything, it's that you should not do that. So.
Well, I don't know what they're going to do next. They've had Godzilla versus Kong, then they've had Godzilla X Kong. You know, how can you stack them on top of each other? I don't understand
Mothra,
what you could possibly do next.
Mothra Origins.
Mothra, the ever-living.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's okay. There's going to be room for a new director.
I was quite intrigued to see that Glenn Powell is going to be doing a new adaptation of Heaven Can Wait. He is officially now the new Warren Beatty, I guess. So this is...
As an actor, yes.
Well, I mean, yes. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not suggesting in his personal life. I have no knowledge there. But yeah, this is the film. It's a long-standing story. It was a 1938 play, but I'm kind of talking about the 70s film, which is the one that Beatty starred in. But it's basically a guy who dies early because an angel kind of messes up and returns to Earth in the body of a recently murdered millionaire instead, and complications ensue. So, I don't know. It's a decent concept. I've seen worse concepts. It's already been done three times, though, so hopefully they have something new to add to it, but I think it's not a bad sort of star vehicle for him.
Exciting stuff all around. Shall we have a guest?
Why not?
Please.
We have George Miller.
Yes.
Or we have George Miller.
It's Miller time.
It is Miller time, folks. That is absolutely right. George Miller, one of the greatest living directors, of course. He is the Australian medical doctor turned movie-making madman behind the Mad Max franchise. He hadn't made a Mad Max movie in, 30-odd years before he made Fury Road in 2015. And at the ripe old age of 70-something, came back and schooled all those action-making young whippersnappers and showed them how to do it with an all-time chrome-plated classic. And now he is back, 9 years later with the prequel to Fury Road, Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, starring Anya Taylor-Joy as Furiosa, the character played, of course, by Charlize Theron in Fury Road, and Chris Hemsworth as a rather colourful bad guy called Dementis. It also stars Tom Burke as a character called the Praetorian Jack, and Lockie Hume, who's an Australian actor who plays a couple of roles in this, but he plays also, within that, the Immortan Joe. He was played by the late, great Hugh Keysburn in the first movie. The reason I'm telling you all of this, I'm sure you know a lot of it already, but is that because this is a lot of the stuff we discussed in this interview with George Miller. This is a longer interview than we usually would do on the podcast these days, but it's George Miller, and I was very, very delighted and privileged to sit down with him and have a good old chat about the movie. We do not go into spoiler territory, you will be delighted to know, and we did not go into spoiler territory at all with George this time around, but we are hoping to be able to do a full-blown sit-down, epic sit-down with George at some point over the coming weeks and months to talk about Furiosa, because there's a lot to talk about, as you'll find out on the other side of this when we get to the review section. But right now, this is me talking to the great George Miller. Do please enjoy. George Miller, director of Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you?
Very good. It's nice to talk to you again.
Likewise. Yeah. I mean, there's so much to talk about in this movie. Yeah.
In person this time.
In person.
It's really interesting, the difference between talking to people on Zoom and
how do you find it?
Well, we got, through COVID, we got so used to doing it.
Yeah.
That it's almost a bit strange to be with someone in the flesh.
Nature is healing.
Yeah, exactly.
Because a year ago, this probably wouldn't have happened.
No, it would have been on
Zoom. But it does make you think, because you obviously adjust to new production techniques to help make this movie, things that didn't exist when you made Fury Road that now exist to make things a little bit easier in terms of shooting. And when we spoke for Empire magazine, you were talking about how this was essentially ready to go around the same time as Fury Road. And Charlize actually came up to you and said, can we shoot this? Can we do Furiosa first and then do Fury Road?
Yes.
Had you shot Furiosa at that time, would it have been markedly different? Would it have been a much harder film to make?
Gee, I never considered that. There's no question. We wanted to shoot Fury Road for such a long time. Mm. It was an exercise. It started off with a simple question: how much story can you tell on the run?
Yeah,
if there was a chase or a race, ultimately, something playing out almost in real time. How much of all the, not only the subtext, but all the internal logic of a world could you pick up? So we had to write Furiosa. I don't know how different it would have been. Probably some of the design would have been different. Uh-huh. It's an interesting thing to contemplate. I'm kind of glad it happened this way, though, mm-hmm. because this film runs directly into Fury Road. They literally butt it up against each other, and it just occurred to me a couple of days ago that the only film similar to that, the only circumstance similar to that, was Godfather 2 coming after Godfather 1.
Yeah.
And Godfather 2 happens to me up there at the top of my list of, but the film which I the film which basically followed me out of the cinema for the longest time. It basically was such a powerful film to me. And I thought, yes, even though that tells you, you know, it jumps in time, but it gave you a sense of who those characters were, particularly Don Corleone from an early time. This is kind of similar to that.
Yeah. I imagine on Fury Road, Charlize, if she came up to you and asked you questions about how did Furiosa get here?
Yes.
What is the origin of this? Where did that come from? Yeah. You already had all the answers.
We had that. We had that. And not only Charlize, but, the War Boys under Immortan Joe, people like with the People Eater, who was the guardian of Gastown at the time, the Bullet Farmer. I was able to show him pictures of what we thought Bullet Farm looked like. Not pictures, but concept art.
Of course.
And so on and so on. Every designer, you know, we had a sense of what, you know, we had that for everybody, including Max in that time. Otherwise, I honestly don't know how we could have told the story in Fury Road. The design would have been random.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been glued together as well. All the threads of the tapestry wouldn't have kind of been woven together properly. I believe that.
That process is fascinating to me, though. As a director, you're meant to have all the answers when people come up to you on set and they ask you 100 questions a day.
Yeah.
And I imagine, George, you're a meticulous man. Do people come up to you on set on this or in Fury Road and stump you with a question? Or do you know everything about this world?
I think it's why I enjoy writing the films I make, because they come a lot of things arise out of the work. You have to, both in what you decide, what is necessary moment to moment, and the things you exclude, you know. So, you know, I can't think of, I'm sure there have been moments where people stump me, but I can't think of it. What is interesting to me, though, mm-hmm. is when you get with the actors mm-hmm. and you're working and they see more about their characters than you see yourself, because they have to sort of embody the characters in some way.
Of course.
And they've thought about it. In the preparation, you basically try to have some understanding of every dimension of a character, but often they come up. I mean, when Chris Hemsworth first read the screenplay, he was picking up things that I had never even occurred to me, and
such as,
well, for instance, there was the teddy bear.
Yeah.
It was in an early concept art. It just was randomly part of his costume. And then he started to ask questions about what the teddy bear meant. And then he had an idea that it must have had some significance to him. What sort of significance? What did it mean to him? Was it sentimental? And as he asked those sort of questions, the teddy bear became more and more significant in the story. That's one example. I had the same from Anya when she kept asking questions. Indeed, most of the characters, most of the actors were that. That's one of the exciting things about it. I mean, the thing is discovered collaboratively with a whole group of people. So
yeah,
it's not. But I think to get to the point, I think that it's in terms of a director, I think it's your job to try to bring all those strands together and make sure that everybody was working to the same kind of organizing ideas.
Yeah.
So that the world seemed integrated and intact and you know, everything, every gesture, every utterance, every bit of costume or prop or vehicle and so on. So all of that, you know, when you're designing vehicles, for instance, they have to be an extension of the character. Mm. And if you plot through all of the Mad Max stories, Max's vehicle reflected what was happening to his character and so on.
It's interesting because we don't want to tread into spoiler territory for this interview. We'll hopefully do that down the line. But I was really struck by the war rig when we see the war rig for the first time in this film, and it is shiny and chrome in a way that it isn't really in Fury Road.
Yeah.
And I think that really reflects the Praetorian Jack's character, because he is the essentially the only real vessel of goodness in this world.
Yeah. Oh, great. Yeah, good. Well, Nico Lutherus and I call it the inverted world.
Mm-hmm.
The world most of us are fortunate to live in basically goes pretty smoothly for us all. To have this interview, we're relying on technology that there's a lot of trust in the process. I've got some water here from a bottle. Now, I in other times, I'd have to question, is that water safe to drink?
Yeah.
Somebody was responsible for packaging that.
Yeah.
And so there's, by and large, the world moves smoothly. You know, we all got here on aeroplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And think about all the things, all the cooperation, all the good positive behavior that has to happen to land an aeroplane over a city.
Yeah.
We only hear about the aeroplanes that crash. We only hear about when someone gets poisoned by something in this world. That's the world by and large. I mean, I know there's pockets of it where it's much darker and much more brutal.
Mm.
But now the world of the wasteland is flipped.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. So that the only behaviors that really shine out that are abnormal are those in which one person has positive regard for another.
Yeah.
I think, and that's Praetorian Jack in this case. I mean, he's a road warrior. He's in charge of this rig, and there's a lot of killing going on. but
he's not without blood in his hands.
But,
yeah.
And there's the whole moral injury that comes with that.
Mm-hmm.
But he sees something in Furiosa.
Yep.
Again, without giving too much away, he sees something in Furiosa. He recognizes, but initially it's because of necessity.
Yeah.
He has to recruit her. And bit by bit, he basically surrenders himself.
Mm-hmm.
To her dream, really. Yeah.
When I interviewed Tom for the magazine, he told me that he had actually auditioned for Fury Road. He had been one of the many people who had auditioned for Max in Fury Road. But do you remember that at all?
Who?
Tom Burke.
For Max?
Yeah. He'd been in a room many, many years before with other people dressed as Max. And he put himself up for the role, but...
I don't believe that.
Yeah, it's true.
I didn't see... You mean, did he do... I didn't meet people.
I don't think he quite got to the U stage, but yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
Isn't it? I had no idea. You know what happened with Tom? Nikki Barrett, the casting agent, made up a list, as they do. And she made up a list of actors, and I think his name... was about, this is for Praetorian Jack.
Yeah.
And his name was about third or fourth on the list. And I think there were about 20 names on the list. And I got to his name, and the moment was there, I didn't read the rest of the names because I'd seen him in Joanna Hogg's movie, The Souvenir.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he just blew me away. And then I saw him in Mank. You know, I had seen him in Mank. And I said, if Tom wants to do it, he's got to do it. I had no idea that. He never told me that.
Yeah, no, yeah. He's around here somewhere. George, you should go and have a chat with him. It's interesting because Chris Hemsworth was never one of the people you saw for Max back then.
No.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I knew of him. No, the only Australian actor I saw was Heath Ledger. Yeah. Every time he'd come to Sydney, he'd call in and we'd talk about it. For a long time, it was, for me, it was going to be him.
Yeah.
And And then we lost him.
Yeah, of course. Oh, man. But Chris is fantastic in this. And you were talking about the way that he locked in, zoomed in on the bear. And yeah. It's interesting to me that, again, without giving too much away, that there's he and Petori and Jack are almost mirror images of each other. They're people who've both lost something in the wasteland. They both lost people in the wasteland. Yeah. And they've chosen to take a particular path.
Ah, that's interesting. Yeah.
And
it's true.
Yeah. And again, and then they've impacted Furiosa in different ways as a result.
Well, again, Chris, two things with Chris. I mean, he's a man, there's a lot of dimensions to him. That's the thing I picked up the first time I met him and had conversation about everything. He's accumulated a lot of wisdom. For a relatively young person, understanding about life, work, how you approach the work, the discipline, and so on. And as I got to know him, I realized that came, part of it's intrinsic and a lot of it's from his family. Mm. Both of his parents are social workers and very influential. So they're retired now, but they were very influential in the city, in the state where they came from, Victoria, in Australia, with child abuse. And they pioneered work in that. Now, that what they learned from that obviously got to the kids and all the brothers. They carry all that stuff with them. So his understanding of trauma was really acute. And he spoke about the character really, really from that point of view. And then he wrote, a journal, trying to sort of corral all his feelings about it. He got up one night, and he started to write, and it was my memory was about 4 or 5 pages, almost stream of consciousness about the character, and there was only about three words crossed out, and he started a sentence again. And I read it, and I thought, my God. He's really deep down into this. He knows every dimension of Dementis.
Yeah,
just in those 5 pages. That's one thing that's a cerebral exercise. But then I started to see that emerge as we started to shoot the movie, as we proceeded to shoot the movie, and I think all that effort and that preparation is up there on the screen.
Yeah.
So. That was it. That sort of, I don't know, athleticism, emotional athleticism comes from somewhere and he was able to provide that. That blew me away, quite honestly.
Yeah, he's amazing. Yeah. And I want to talk about Anya as well, of course, as Furiosa. But before we do, there's a couple of examples in this movie of actors playing dual roles.
Yes.
Which is, a grand Mad Max tradition in a way. Hugh Keysburn, of course, played Toe Cutter, and of course, Liam Morton Joe in Fury Road. And I just wanted to talk about that, where that comes from. There's a couple of actors, one whose name I won't mention in case people don't know, who plays two roles. But then obviously, you've got Lockie Hume, who plays Rizdel Pell, and Liam Morton Joe as well. Is that something that you're keen on doing?
Well, It happens partly out of not knowing which other way to go. I won't go through all of it. To give Lockie's example, he was playing Rizdel Pell, mm-hmm. who's one of Dementis's bikers, and we were going to do in Morton Joe by getting an actor who could sound like him, and then use deep fake to make him. Look like Immortan Joe.
Mm.
And we did some tests and it looked promising and that was going to be our approach. Lockie came to me and he came to me and Nico and he said, look, I think I would like to have a go at doing Immortan Joe. I said, Lockie, but we've already got someone else to do it. And he said, okay, if it doesn't work for you, just keep me in mind. And as we did further tests, it wasn't working. The actor we had, a very fine actor, But basically, physically, we had to change. He didn't have the height or the basic shape. Mm-hmm. It could have worked, but so I said, Lucky, let's give it a go. So we and he did, and he nailed it for me. I was surprised. Obviously I knew Hugh and his work intimately, but he persuaded me that he's the Immortan Joe. And I was, every time I see him, I give him a big hug and say, thank you for being so insistent. You know, it's not just an actor somehow inserting himself. He knew that he could do it. When I didn't know that he could do it, so this did a brilliant job.
This was during production as well. You'd shot his stuff.
Yeah.
I love that. That shows you can roll with the punches still. You know.
Well, that's one of the things you have to do as a director. It's never locked in and fixed. You have to not so much roll the punches, be agile enough to adjust to the circumstances. In fact, there's some of my favorite stories about filmmaking, about how people do that.
Yeah. Did anything like that happen on this, apart from obviously casting Lockie?
I keep going back to Fury Road, where it was quite striking. I'm sure it happens. Look, it happens every day. Yeah. Small adjustments,
happy accidents.
Yeah, happy or not even happy accidents. Better, clearer ideas pop up, and it's something that an actor might feel, or an actor does, or it might be a shift in camera. There are little micro adjustments that are happening all the time to find the right rhythm. But in Fury Road, I know we don't have much time, but there's a scene where we were shooting the moment when Furiosa meets the Vavolini.
Yeah,
and she's saying, she meets Valkyrie, she meets them. They're talking. We're out in Namibia, and it was an incredibly windy day, such a windy day that a couple of the characters who had white hair or blonde hair, the dust got in the hair and it looked orange. We had to decolor it in post. and then we suddenly saw the wind across the dune. And I think Charlize said, can we shoot that scene, which where she basically realizes that the green place is no longer there. And we went in there, and we got the camera in position. The sun was exactly in the right position, and the wind kept blowing in the right direction. So we put our cameras in the shot. And she started one take, and I said stop because something happened with her arm. And then we did take two, and the wind basically was so strong it blew out footsteps. We didn't have to adjust the camera so that it evened out the footstep. And then she did that take. Now that's an example. Had it not been windy that day, and had I not been cursing the wind, and yet not been alert to the opportunity, we wouldn't have had that moment and that shot. It wouldn't have been there. That sort of thing, I think, happens most time, and I think that's part of the job. I recognize. I didn't understand that when I first started to make films, but I realized that you've got to be agile enough to take. And you hear, and that's always happened with filmmakers. Great stories about, John Ford shooting in storms in Monument Valley, and that wonderful moment in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I was thinking about that.
When Harrison Ford said, "Why don't I just shoot him?" gave us one of the best moments in the movie and in cinema. And things like that, yeah.
What is it about the desert or sand that makes people improvise, George?
I don't know, but it's a great place to shoot because there are figures in the landscape, great for composition, clarity of the image, and humans look great in the desert.
Absolutely.
And it occurred to me in the same way that I was attracted to Antarctica because penguins look great in the desert of Antarctica.
Yeah. you're working now with Anya and not Charlize, and do you have to make an adjustment when you have a different actor in a role? Do you have to make an adjustment as director?
No, not so much. The process is the same because we're telling a story of Furiosa from when she's 10 until she's 28. Mm-hmm. And the main question was, can Anya fill the shoes of Charlize? I mean, she's got to get to where we saw Charlize as Furiosa. In the process of casting it, I had an intuitive response to her. I felt mm-hmm. she was the there's something about her. There's a certain mystique to her. There's this wonderful intensity to her. There's a sense of great resolute, both in her work. She's very disciplined and so on. You know the story of Edgar Wright and mm-hmm. how he that's where I first saw her, when he showed me an early cut of his film Last Night at Soho. He was just, without hesitation, he just said, she's got it all, do it, whatever you want. He didn't even know it was Furiosa. And then he didn't know. After we talked about the film, I said, you know, Anya, she'd be right for, and I remember I said, she'd be right for, and he just said, do it, and said, anyway, so he and he's someone who I really trust, and he was true. It was true. And then I got to know her, and I got to know how she came to acting. I got to know about her ballet from a young age, and the way she's very, very, you know, there's something about her that there's a kind of a mystique to her. It's almost sort of regal. And there's an intensity to her that you feel she's capable of a ferocity. Mm-hmm. And you know it's all there in the face and the eyes. She has very little dialogue. You know, as everyone knows by now, I was fascinated by the silent cinema, mm-hmm. because what they would do with pure, or what I call visual music. All the great actors in the silent cinema had you couldn't go past their eyes. You had to look at their eyes. Even my great hero Buster Keaton, that face and that eyes, despite all the other stuff he was doing. So that was there, and then it's only through the process that you go through that you can actually see, you go through the process, and the actor and the character somehow merge in some way, and then you go into the cutting room, and there's no question at that moment that they are definitely they're only the character, the actor completely disappears, at least when you see. At least with the great performances, yeah.
Well, George, last time I spoke to you for Fury Road back in 2015, obviously it was quite a difficult shoot, and so you were talking about this, and you were talking about the Wasteland, the Max centric movie, but obviously you weren't quite ready to return to the Wasteland for some time.
Yeah,
took some time away, made 3,000 years of longing, of course, and then came back to Furiosa. Now this film's 2.5 weeks in the can.
Yeah,
are you ready to go back already, or do you want some time off?
No, but it's somewhere. It's somewhere along. I've got to the age now where there's a lot of, well, several stories that are quite mature that I have. Not Mad Max related, but they're kind of, there's a kind of a little Darwinian struggle. Some insist,
make me.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah. Because you find yourself in those, you catch yourself thinking about, we can do that or that scene or so on. And that's what happened. With Furiosa, we were preparing that while I was making while we were making 3,000 Years of Longing, because it's a story I wanted to tell. It's a one that was foremost in my mind whenever, you know, in those unguarded moments. It's interesting how that happens. You feel a sort of a gravitational pull towards mm-hmm. them. And I think it's because there's a richness that's offered up. You can't stop thinking of all the possibilities as they're kind of swirling around the back of your head.
Okay, that was George Miller talking about Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. And there is only one place to start with this week's reviews section. It is, of course, Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. John, you wrote the 5-star Empire review of Furiosa. Let's just call it Furiosa, dispense with the Mad Max saga. Tell us why.
Well,
that sounds challenging. I agree with it. I think this film is phenomenal. But tell the people why you gave it 5 stars.
Why? I mean, I'm the reviews editor, so I'd commission myself.
So what I say goes, motherfucker.
That's right.
Can you take a star off my Attack of the Clones review, please? 2 stars. Why not?
Why? Well, it is, I mean, we all know what this is, right? This is the prequel to Mad Max Fury Road.
As yeah, explain you, that, John.
As you...
Jesus, were you listening?
So clearly said. it is several years before the events of Fury Road. Fury Road, it's a very different film. So Fury Road was set over the course of, I think, 3 days. It's mm-hmm. about 36 hours. This film is set over the course of 15 years. So we join Furiosa...
In real time as well, which is a bold
hey,
move for Dr.
On.
George.
It's only a mere two and a bit hours.
Two and a half. Yeah.
So we join the young Furiosa played by Alelia Brown. I believe I'm pronouncing that name right.
Brown, that's correct. Yes.
Thank you. When she's in the green place. So we're seeing these things that are only mentioned in Fury Road. The green place is this sort of, you know, lost paradise in the wastelands that Furiosa, young Furiosa, grows up in. And she's kidnapped by the foot soldiers of a warlord known as Dementus.
Good name.
Played by Chris Hemsworth with a big nose. And the film is kind of an odyssey, a journey for Furiosa to try and find her way back home. She gets thrown between, you know, different warlords. She eventually ends up at the Citadel run by Morton Joe, played by Lockie Hume. It's sort of about her journey, essentially. It's about her trying to get back to the green place, but also, I guess, an inward journey. It's her learning to deal with trauma, all of this sort of thing. But it's also George Miller Mad Max film. So there's crazy shit happening. There is war rigs. There is action. There is incredible set pieces. Mm. It's a lot. It's a lot of film. I mean, it's. I think it's divided into 5 chapters, so it doesn't feel quite as singular and propulsive.
With
as
very
Fury
pretentious
Road.
Subtitles.
I think the first one is called The Pole of Inaccessibility.
Indeed. Which is a new Peter Strickland kids movie.
I think if you're going in expecting Fury Road Part 2...
There's a section in this movie that gives you that.
Sure.
Furiosa Road.
There is a chapter which is essentially more of Fury Road. There is an assault on a war rig, and it feels like it could have been a deleted scene from that film. But on the whole, structurally, tonally, it is very different. And
very much,
I think you have to be on board with that. If you do get on board with that, you know, slight change in direction and approach, I think you can have a really good time with this film. I think it's an incredibly well-mounted film. I mean, it looks incredible. It has a different look in some ways. Mm. I mean, it was shot in a different place. I think Fury Road was shot in Namibia, was it?
Namibia, yeah.
And this is back in George Miller's native Australia.
And it relies more heavily on CGI, I think. Than
there
Fury
is a
Road
bit
did.
More CGI.
Obvious CGI.
But that didn't bother me. I don't think that bothered me. But just because the level of stunt work is still... Like,
yeah, that's fair.
Head and shoulders above most films you will see in cinemas today.
I think it lacks the propulsive simplicity, obviously, of Fury Road, which is a very singular, relentless experience, whereas this is much bittier by design. And I also think sometimes there is a less is more thing. Look, we've talked about prequels an awful lot, and I think sometimes when you take away from mythology, you ultimately are detracting from the whole.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't need to know more about, you know, Gastown or the Bullet Farm. Like, I felt I was perfectly happy just knowing that they existed.
Almost just the name. are enough.
Exactly. It's enough. You know exactly what I didn't need the mythology of that. And I felt where the first film is all character, no plot, I felt this was a lot more plot and a lot less character because, you know, they were trying to spell out so much stuff. I think, you know, Furiosa comes to you perfectly fully formed in Fury Road. And I don't need to know her motivation. I don't need to know where she comes from. I don't need to know how she loses her arm. You know, I kind of was almost happier not knowing that stuff. Mm-hmm. All of that said, this is an extremely, as you say, an extremely well-mounted film. And it's, I mean, it's fucking relentless. At the end of this, I came out, I needed to be left alone for a good 15 minutes just to settle down because I was all of a flutter and I needed some smelling salts. and I will say, and this is true of pretty much everything George Miller's done, but in particular, this is, I think, the most Australian movie ever made. There is literally a bit where someone's like, oh, fire up the bombie knocker! And I was like, this is just incredible. And I loved every second of it. And
have you also seen Crocodile Dundee 3?
Even that, there is no bombie knocker in Crocodile Dundee 1, 2, or 3. I will say that, I had a lot of fun with this. I had a lot of fun with the character names, Scrotus, Piss Boy, and the Octoboss. I loved at the end credits, when he lists the cast, he gives all the character names. They get their own screen time. So you get all of those brilliant names for these wild sort of war boy characters. Mm-hmm. So it's just brilliant.
Shout out Rictus Erectus.
Yes, who makes a spectacular comeback.
Yeah.
I agree with a lot of what James says, and you know how much that upsets me. I think that I have a long-standing issue with prequels, as frequent listeners will know, and for all those reasons. We don't need the mythology demythologized. We don't need backstory. And also it removes a lot of the stakes. Like, you're pretty sure Dementis isn't going to survive. You're pretty sure Furiosa will. Mm. Other characters I won't mention, but, you know, you draw your own conclusions pretty quickly. And I think that's a shame. The action scenes were, for the most part, flawless, once again. I did think some of the CG this time, there's one shot near the start where someone is getting on a horse. And it made me want to throw something at the screen.
Oh, there's a shot on top of the war rig where the compositing, I thought, was glaringly obvious. That felt like a reshoot, to be honest.
Yeah, there were a couple of moments of just bad CG. And given the brilliant use and mix of, you know, VFX and SFX in the first one, you know, we maybe had too high expectations of this.
I mean, there's some shonky stuff in Fury Road as well.
Maybe, but nothing that leapt out at me the way some of the shots in this one did. So, you know, I liked this, but I did not love it. I was not blown away by it. And I certainly don't think it was up to Fury Road standards. That said, I'll watch it again and hopefully, you know, fall more in love.
I mean, I would say I don't think it's better than Fury Road. I don't think it's even quite at
Yeah, but
the
you were upfront about that when you came out. Yeah. You were very clear on that.
But I still think it is head and shoulders above, you know, the sort of standard of blockbusters that we're getting these days. I think it's a remarkable piece of work. I think, you know, it is. I agree with you on the prequel stuff. I think there's a lot of stuff you don't need to know, and yet the world building in this film is amazing. Like the sort of the visual language of places like Bullet Town and Gas Town and the Bullet Farm are just remarkable. Mm. Really, I love the dystopian sprawling mass. I love that the wastelands feel bigger and smaller at the same time. You know, this world is like sort of endlessly fascinating. Mm.
A bit more detail being filled in this time about what happened to conjure up the wasteland in the first place.
I really do think this is a film that it will stand the test of time.
But it's also it's a cinema film, right? Like, this is 100% something you want to see in the cinema.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. I think this film is willfully uncommercial at times. And I really hope it does well at the box office, but I can see a world where it has a good opening weekend and then tails off pretty quickly as audiences, for the most part, reject it because it's a strange movie. We should also bear in mind, of course, that Fury Road wasn't a huge box office success. It did pretty well. It made just under $400 million, if I remember rightly, back in 2015, so just enough to eventually get Warner Brothers to go in on this one again and to greenlight the sequel. But I think the fact that its reputation rose over the years, and obviously it got Oscar nominated and won 6 Oscars, and George Miller should have won Best Director that year, and the fact that he didn't is a disgrace. That film is incredible. But what that film also is incredibly simple, and it is a chase movie. There's a lot of complexity to it, and the world is so thought out and fleshed out and Nicola Thuris, who is the co-writer in this movie with George Miller. He's a sort of dramaturg who worked with him on Fury Road as well, and kind of wrote Furiosa basically, you know, as a way to, when they were preparing Fury Road, as a way for them to really get to grips with the world and how big the world was, and also to help with the actors and, okay, let's write your backstories. And they got to the point where Charlize Theron came up to George just before they were about to start shooting Fury Road. She had read Furiosa and went, can we make this first instead? And you can see why she wanted to do that. But also you could argue that if they had made Furiosa first, it wouldn't have done well enough for them to get to Fury Road. Yeah. So I'm glad that they went down that route. Fury Road is much more simple. It's much more propulsive. It's much more of a grabber. The action sequence, which is basically the entire film, is an all-timer. This is a frankly weird movie. This is an uncompromising movie. It's such an oddball movie. It doesn't hold your hand at all. It feels like a silent movie for much of the movie. I think it's a $150, $200 million art house movie that George Miller has somehow persuaded Warner Brothers to stump up the cash for. I hope people embrace it. I really do. I don't think it gives you the experience that Fury Road gave you, but if you want to see a true visionary of a director working at the height of his powers, then I would recommend you go see this. And go see it again, because it really, really pays off a second time around as well. 5 stars, then, for Furiosa! Furiosa! Next up, it is Chris Pratt as Garfield in the Garfield movie, A Mad Max Saga. Hell's Bells.
I mean, right.
This is a good start. Every review that starts with, okay, right.
Okay. I mean, okay. I just wonder why. I wonder why we hold on to this idea that Garfield is a kid's character. Garfield wasn't a kid's character, right? Garfield was a 3-panel comic strip that was kind of aimed at adults.
Yeah.
All this stuff about hating Mondays, that's not really a kid's thing. That's more of an adult thing. Okay, but here we are, and they've made him into a kid's character, and we meet, this is a, it's an origin story. Because I think
we've all wondered. An origin story for a cat. How does that work?
All wondered how Garfield first met John. Garfield, obviously voiced by Chris Pratt. John, voiced by Nicholas Hoult. No problems, actually, with the voice cast in this film. I actually think Chris Pratt does a fine job.
Does he sound a lot like Mario?
He just sounds like Chris Pratt, but he sounds fine. His Garfield energy is kind of a little bit, you know, Andy from Parks and Rec, but that works for Garfield. That's okay.
Does it? I'm not a Garfield fan, so I always just assumed Garfield was quite lugubrious and quite, you know, Bill Murray's casting
here,
was... Okay.
But he has that sort of, you know, like lust for life kind of things, or certainly lust for food.
Oh, does he? Because I always thought he was like, lasagna. Mondays. Okay, well, who doesn't love lasagna?
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
So, anyway, he does fine. We meet him as a tiny kitten. He is left in an alley by his dad, who's voiced by Samuel L. Jackson. Again, doing good work. And he sees a lit up, you know, restaurant across the way, and he goes and he manages to get in the window, and there's John, and oh my goodness, and he feeds him, and then they're friends for life. And then some stuff happens later on, and it just becomes, it just turns into a kid's movie. So it just turns into a ridiculous series of stupid things happening, none of which have any meaning or purpose, really. But essentially, Garfield has to team up with his now estranged father to do a ridiculous heist at the behest of Hannah Waddingham, not playing herself. She has a character name, but I don't care. And and that's the movie.
So they have to steal some silly, milk or something.
They have to steal, yeah. So
have to steal some milk.
Some milk to pay off his dad's debts for some reason.
And also reunite
two cows,
one of whom is voiced by Ving Rhames.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's just a silly kids movie. And as a silly kids movie, it will deliver for little kids, and because there are brightly colored people and there are things happening all the time. And that's all there is. There is nothing else. There is no subtext. There are no real jokes here. There is no real content here for grown up people. There's nothing particularly Garfield apart from not liking Mondays. Again, for no reason. He doesn't have a fucking job. he doesn't like Mondays, and he does like pizza and lasagna. So I guess we can identify with that. But like, it's just a film. It just exists. That's about all I can say about it. It's like, there it is.
Who directed it?
This was directed by Mark Dindal.
Mark Dindal, who directed The Emperor's New Groove, which is
a good movie.
A great movie and really fun.
Trouble production, great movie.
It turned out really fun, and it's like a big Chuck Jones cartoon. But this has none of that film's wit. It has none of that film's panache or, you know, it's got nothing.
Jeez.
It just exists, right?
It just exists. It's from Sony, but it's not made by Sony Pictures Animation, who did Spider-Verse. It doesn't have that sort of creativity or that sort of innovation in animation. It feels more like an Illumination movie, if you know what I mean.
It does, but not even with the kind of... I don't love Illumination, but they have a madcap kind of zaniness sometimes that, you know, is something. It's some kind of trademark. This has nothing to hold on to, is my feeling about it.
Yeah, I can't really disagree. It left no impression on me. I was a bit bored by it. There was like maybe one joke I raised a smile at. It's not funny. And fundamentally, I think, as you're saying, Helen, it just misunderstands the character of Garfield. I don't know that Garfield should be...
A movie? No, I don't think so either.
I don't think... Or at least not a family-friendly kids film. Like, it just doesn't make any sense.
No.
They're trying to... It's so sentimental and schmaltzy, this film. Like, the whole ending is just, like, going for tear-jerking. And you just think... What? This is Garfield. This is a cynic. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
Two stars?
Two stars.
Two stars then for the Garfield movie. Jimbo.
Hello.
Atlas.
Shrugged.
Hey. Oh, dear.
Wow.
Ah, yes. Atlas, this is a new Netflix movie directed by Brad Peyton of Rampage fame. If you've ever played the video game Titanfall... Hey, don't come for Rampage. But anyway, this is, if you've ever played the video game Titanfall, this is like Titanfall... Mm-hmm. The film. And this stars Jennifer Lopez. And it really stars Jennifer Lopez because she gives this 100% from the second she walks on screen to the end of it. And she is the consummate professional. And no matter how absolutely absurd the gibberish coming out of her mouth, she absolutely fucking sells it.
Love
her. Massive respect to J-Lo for this. And she plays the brilliantly named Atlas Shepherd. And she's a kind of a misanthropic... analyst. She's like an expert in robotics, but she has a deep distrust of all artificial intelligence and robots because of quote-unquote deep personal trauma in her past. And however, she is sent on a mission to go to a planet to track down the leader of the AIs who have essentially wiped out half of humanity. Basically,
like
it's
3 million people, I think, actually. Yeah. Not half.
Not half, okay. Just a small amount. Oh, so it's fine, actually. They've done nothing wrong. It's all good.
I'm just saying.
It's basically what happens when ChatGPT goes rogue. That's what this film is. So the AIs have decided they want to wipe out all of humanity, as all AIs eventually come to that particular conclusion. So she goes to a planet to deal with this guy, Harlan Plurt, who's played by Simu Liu. And
who does ChatGPT play?
No. And it all goes horribly wrong. Now, this planet, crucially, is toxic. So she ends up in a mech suit.
That's Brittany.
Shut up. She ends up in a mech suit so that she can survive. And she is essentially stuck in this suit for the duration of this film, which is really what worried me about this, because she is literally, it's just her on a soundstage in like this suit and everything outside it is CGI. So it's J-Lo in a mech surrounded by CGI for the whole film. Now...
Most of the film, anyway.
Most of the film. She gets out occasionally, but broadly speaking, that's what this is. And that did concern me, because I thought that's a very, very limited, you know, playground for us to exist in. But nevertheless, I think And the whole thing hinges on the fact that this mech suit, I should say, has an AI built into it. The AI is called Smith. It is voiced by Gregory James Cohen. And she obviously hates the AI. She has a real thing about robots. But eventually, much like Will Smith in iRobot, she has to get over her mistrust of technology and bond with this AI.
Or like Chuck Nolan, when he had to overcome his fear of volleyballs.
Indeed, and became friends with Wilson. Yes, it's exactly the same as that. And the thing with this film is, and it's very important that you kind of bear this in mind, is it's rubbish. But the other thing, other thing is, it's also brilliant, because I enjoyed this so much. I had the most fun in this film. And yet at no point were you to ask me the core question, is it good? Could I possibly, with any honesty, have answered,
Yes, because it really isn't, because the dialogue is dreadful. The story is so trite at the end. And while I think actually has a lot of potential up until a point, the last third just descends into the most horrific cliche.
Just let me say, people in Hollywood need to go to less therapy on the basis of this film.
There's a lot of this and her sifting through her trauma and eventually opening up and coming to terms with her path. It's like, nobody cares. You're in a mech with four arms, guns and swords. Just blow some stuff up. Like, it's just, there's a lot of sci-fi fun to be had here. Like, I was giggling and clapping and sort of generally enjoying myself enormously, but it's still a bit rubbish. But I do think people should watch it. So, you know, make of that what you will.
Helen?
I don't disagree. I wrote the review and I gave it 2 stars.
I disagree with nothing that you wrote.
I think that's right. But also, I did enjoy it. I mean, I was just, it's kind of not quite a hate watch, but it's a dislike watch.
It's a guilty pleasure.
It's like you have so much. You have not just Jennifer Lopez and Simu Liu. You also have Mark Strong and Sterling K. Brown in this.
And with nothing to do.
With nothing to do. You have mech suits, you have flying cars, you have a future LA that looks exactly like present-day Singapore. You have so much to work with, and that's what you do? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
It's really a thing. It's really something to see. I mean, it's not good. I mean, it does look like a game as well. Like,
this is not,
you know, it's not just that the plot recalls Titanfall, although very much also iRobot, as you say. But also, like, it literally at times, the CG isn't perhaps the most expensive in the world. They don't have James Cameron money, I'm assuming. And so it looks like a video game a lot of the time. And, you know, you have J-Lo just stuck in a box for most of the time, acting her little heart out, as you say. But, like, why would you stick J-Lo, of all people, in a box?
I do think, had they cast anyone else in this role, this film would have had a very different energy and actually have been just outright bad and miserable. I think she rescued... I mean, not just her. Sterling K. Brown, for all he elevates it as
he
well.
Does,
just
yeah.
good casting yep. all the way all through. The way through. Really elevates us above the source material.
I didn't really know Gregory James Cohen. I don't know if he's done... Maybe he's done
game
voicing or something.
He has a great voice. It's very
really
soothing.
Good voice. And he did a really good performance.
Yeah.
This, you know,
and you really feel the connection between them. And like, you're great. You're like, oh, Smith, yes!
But I mean, not good. And
I know.
Too long. This is 2 hours or just about.
Do you know what? You say that, and you're on paper, you are right. But there was a bit where I was like, I looked at the runtime. I've got half an hour to go. And I was like, yes, I've got another half an hour. I was so excited that there was more of it. Really, really had a good time. Sorry.
How does it compare to This Is Me, a love story?
It's got less CG than that now.
Yeah.
So this is the star of This Is Me and This Is Us in the same film.
That's right.
Wow.
This is them.
Wow. Wow. 2 stars then, but sounds like 5.
It's a five-star film.
Can I just say also, canonically in this film, J-Lo is meant to be 38. Anyway.
Is she?
I can't believe that.
I missed that.
I can totally believe that.
It was 28 years ago that the thing happened when she was 10.
You are right. Although, not being funny, she 100% pulls it off.
I mean,
I would not have questioned that.
She's stunning.
Yeah.
No question, but yeah.
Yeah.
All right, then, 2 stars for Atlas. And last but not least this week is Richard Linklater's Hitman, which reunites him with Glenn Powell. They've made a couple of movies together. And, you know, it's kind of where we saw him first. Hollywood, get your hands off. this is kind of after Anyone But You. This is further confirmation, right, Helen, that Glenn Powell is going to be a huge star. This is in cinemas this weekend, but will be on Netflix in 2 weeks' time. So we'll kind of talk about it then as well when we'll all have seen it.
Yeah.
But right now, just a very, very quick couple of words about Hitman and how ace it is.
It's really ace. I saw this actually last year at the London Film Festival. I think it had just been in, was it Venice or Toronto?
Yes, I saw it at Venice.
Right.
Yeah.
So it did make a buzz there even before Anyone But You came out. But this is a fantastic film. It is improbably based on a true life story at first, and then they wildly go off the fact of the true life story. But it was about a professor, a college professor, hired by the police to play a hitman. So basically what this film tells you is there are essentially no hitmen. If you try and hire a hitman, you will almost certainly hire an undercover cop and be done for conspiracy to murder.
Oh, God.
Really bad news for you.
I'm just going to make a quick phone call.
So he plays the hitman who then has to reel these murder suspects in, essentially, on behalf of a police sting team. And it all gets a bit... He's very good at it. He does it a lot. He really enjoys it as a little sort of fillip in his otherwise boring life. And then he meets one of his would-be clients, who's played by Adria Arjona, and obviously gets in a little bit over his head. This is such a fun film. Now, it isn't going to be on in all cinemas this weekend. I had a look this morning to see if it was on anywhere in Northern Ireland because I wanted to recommend it to a bunch of family and friends, and I couldn't find it there. If it is on in a cinema near you, this is such a great cinema experience. It is so frustrating to me that this is going to be on Netflix because I saw it, as I say, at the London Film Festival. It was a packed morning screening, and it played gangbusters. People were hooting and hollering all over the place. It is so much fun as a collective experience. Mm. There are so many crazy twists and turns of comic scenes. So if you can get to a cinema and see Hitman, I really recommend it. It'll still be great on Netflix in a couple of weeks. It's a great film. It's really, really good fun.
I'm going to see it this long weekend. I'm going to see it and worship at the altar of Richard Linklater, who is an amazing director. Awesome. And Glenn Powell co-wrote this,
Glenn Powell co-wrote it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they wrote it together. And the article on which it is based is online. You can read it. It's the Texas Monthly article. And it's really fun and amazing insight into that world. And it's just, I don't know. It's the most fun Richard Linklater has had in years, I think.
Yeah,
I mean, he's consistently good. But this is like proper blockbuster watch with a packed crowd, as you say, Helen. Yeah. It's
joyful.
Joyful.
It
joyful
really is.
And really sexy as well.
You're really sexy. Yeah, like, absolutely.
Unusually sexy for our current sexless time.
Exactly.
Did someone say my name? All I heard was unusually sexy. Hey. I just assumed you were talking about me.
So yeah, we gave it 4 stars. But like I say, it will still be 4 stars on Netflix. But if you have the opportunity to see this in cinema, take it. Take
right.
it. It's yours.
Yeah, I love those guys. Glenn Powell and Adria Arjona. Yes, yes, please. Yes, please. Very, very good stuff. I should be going to see it this weekend. All right, that's it.
Hooray.
We're done. We're done here. We're done here. That is it for this week's Emperor Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by Daisy Ridley.
Hooray.
Daisy Ridley, star of the new Jerry Bruckheimer production, Young Woman and the Sea. And we'll also be joined by, I think, Richard Linklater.
Ooh.
Director of Hitman. So that's exciting.
I hope it's a Hitman.
I do. I do indeed. Hope that it is a Hitman. All right, that's it. Until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my 3 colleagues of such lethal cunning. James Dyer is staring at me with what can only be described as dark intent.
I don't know why you would think that. But on the Pilot TV podcast this week, we have Helen O'Hara, speaking to Nida Manzoor, the creator of We Are Lady Parts, which is back on Channel 4, which is very, very exciting. We're also doing the new Stephen Knight show.
Woo!
That's right. We're doing the new Stephen Knight show, The Veil, and also The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Live, finally makes its way to the UK on Sky. So that's very exciting as well.
Yeah.
Come listen to Helen talk to Nina Manzoor about Lady Parts.
Yes, do that.
And hello to her because she listens to this podcast sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, she does. God bless her. I thought she was smart too, but apparently not.
Please accept my apologies and backdate those apologies however long you've been listening. So goodbye from John Nugent.
Goodbye.
Is that it?
I have no podcast to plug. I'm just going to say goodbye.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, it's been fun having you, John.
Thanks.
But your new documentary, Let It Be, is available now, streaming on Disney Plus. So.
That's right.
Yeah. Doesn't even cover the bit where John walked out on the Beatles for about 3 days or something like that. Or a week.
That's in Get Back, though, isn't it?
It's in Get Back, yeah. You remember it well?
Yes.
like it was yesterday.
Jinx. Oh, now James can't speak. Damn it. It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. As Chuck Noland once said to his folly ball, Wilson, in Robert Zemeckis' Castaway, I know now why you cry, but it is something I can never do, sweetheart.
What? I like the Groucho Marx hand gesture doing that. It's unclear why, but sure.
I think I'm dying.
But you sound like James Cagney.
I think I nailed it. I think I absolutely nailed it. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.